And welcome back to Back in Style, the Twisted Mug Media Network's Twin Peaks podcast. I am Logan, Twin Peaks veteran.
And I'm Matthew, the Twin Peaks newbie.
And if you're listening to this at home, it's probably not been too long for you since our last episode was released. The full review of Twin Peaks Firewalk with me. But for us, it's been quite a while. We got really ahead on recording and... You know, recorded that Firewalk with Me episode months ago, and we haven't really been doing too much with it. But you know, since then, what have you been up to, Matt? How are you doing?
I've been doing well. I will say, watching the missing pieces in preparation for this podcast, I totally forgot about a lot of the things going on in Twin Peaks where we are right now. I had to kind of reacclimate myself with the ending of Firewalk with Me, how that all connected. This happens a lot in Back in Style. We do take long breaks, and often I do have to kind of re-enter into the world of Twin Peaks. But it's always lovely to come back in.
It's always such a, you know, it's such a specific vibe, and it's just, you just are able to get sucked right back into it immediately.
Yes.
With these sounds, these visuals from Lynch, it's just, you know, it's all so well done, and I also found it challenging. So it had been a while since I'd seen Firewalk with Me, you know, since we had reviewed it. So I watched it again today, then watched The Missing Pieces, and now I'm here, and I'm ready to do this. So, I guess just to kind of give some background for our listeners, Firewalk with Me was released in 1992, the prequel film to slash partially sequel film. I don't know. Is it future or is it past? Mm. To the Twin Peaks television series back in 1990, and The Missing Pieces were released. I was just looking at this. They were released in theaters, or at least just in one specific theater. In LA, in the summer of 2014, prior to the release of Twin Peaks: The Entire Mystery, which is a box set that came out, I believe that same year. So yeah, these were some deleted scenes that are cut together, and basically what this episode is going to be is we are going to be talking about 10 of our favorite deleted scenes. Some of them I picked, some of them Matt picked. Some of them we both decided together, we've just got to talk about this one. So yeah, we're just going to sort of go through, we did a similar kind of format on The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer, which was a really fun episode to do, so definitely go back and listen to that if you're interested. Yeah, Matt, I mean, anything else before we get started?
No, I don't think so. But yeah, I guess we hinted at this at the beginning, but if this is your first time listening to the show, Logan has seen the entire show before, you know, this and including The Return. He's the Twin Peaks expert. This is my first time going through the show, so I have not seen anything past The Missing Pieces. Therefore, we will not spoil anything past The Missing Pieces if you are like me. So, you know, wherever you are in terms of Twin Peaks community, feel free to listen to this.
Yes, we're not going to talk about anything about The Return. We're not going to talk about the final dossier or secret history of Twin Peaks. Those are off our radar for now.
For now.
We will be getting to those, all of those. So yeah, I mean, let's just, you know, let's start at my first selection. It's the fourth deleted scene, and it's called "This One's Coming from J. Edgar," and it fills in a teeny tiny little plot hole that I don't think anyone was really asking to be filled in from Firewalk with Me, but there's a moment where Chet Desmond and Sam Stanley are trying to get the body of Teresa Banks to take back to Seattle, maybe, to do some kind of like nerve analysis, and Sheriff Cable is the guy in Deer Meadows, and he's, you know, he doesn't want to cooperate with the feds, with these two FBI agents, and he gives them a little trouble, but then somehow in the movie they just sort of, like, get the body and they're able to take it back. I'd say there's a happy medium between not showing us anything about how they got the body and showing us this incredibly long scene. So the deleted scene that I'm talking about, it's a really long fight scene with no music, very little dialogue, but it's just a fight between Chet Desmond, played by Chris Isaac, and this Sheriff Cable character. it's just like, it just goes on for so long.
It's absurd.
I can understand why they cut it, but on a certain level, I appreciate it. Because we had talked about the name of Sheriff Cable, you know, the fact that his name is Cable. Maybe this is Lynch taking out some of his, you know, secret frustrations on, you know, ABC, the network that forced him to reveal Laura's killer. So I think, you know, this scene is just, it's another way that maybe Lynch is kind of literalizing that. It's the FBI literally beating up, you know, cable TV, the idea of cable TV, which I think is pretty entertaining.
It is really entertaining. Yeah, because in Firework With Me, we see the photo of Cable in his office bending that piece of iron, and we finally get that moment in the scene where Chris Isaacs stands over top of him and bends the piece himself. It's a really absurd scene. Like a lot of these deleted scenes, there's like no music over top of it. And I do wonder, you know, is it just because, you know, this didn't make it into the movie, they weren't that far along in the editing process, or... Because I know the version I watched, David Lynch kind of edited and compiled all the deleted scenes together, and there was music over top some of them. Maybe he just wanted to keep it as absurd as possible. I don't know. But either way, it is... Yeah, it's goofy. I'm glad it's not in the movie, but I like its inclusion here.
Yeah, I feel exactly the same way. I'm glad it's not in the movie, but I'm glad it's in the missing pieces. Not only do we see Cable bend the bar, but... when he tosses it to the side, there's like a whole pile of bent bars over there. I think he does this like routinely to intimidate people.
Clearly done this before. And it's worked on everyone else, apparently.
Apparently, but not on Chet Desmond.
Apparently not. And he like exudes 50s rock and roll icon like energy, both as a musician and the rest of in Firewalk With Me. But in this scene, it's just totally epitomizes that. He takes off the shirt, he's just got this white, you know, white plain tee, and the hair is kind of flopping over. It was great. He was a lot of fun here.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun to watch. My next scene, so speaking of Chet Desmond, we have his counterpart Sam Stanley, played by Kiefer Sutherland, you know, before 24, before he was really all that big.
So good.
Yeah, he's fantastic in Fire Walk With Me. He's fantastic in this deleted scene. This scene is called Stanley's Apartment. This is one that I picked. And I like it because it sort of bridges the gap between the Teresa Banks Dear Meadows segment and sort of the rest of the movie, the Laura Palmer storyline. And, you know, we get to see Dale Cooper and Sam Stanley interacting. I just think it's so much fun. You have Kyle MacLachlan and Kiefer Sutherland in a scene together. You know, pretty wild. Nothing much really happens in it. Stanley's just sort of talking about the machine. He's talking about the letter, found under Teresa's fingernail. But yeah, I don't know. Was the scene memorable at all to you?
It was memorable because there was like a weird sort of tension between the two, which is sort of a disconnect between Twin Peaks, because Agent Cooper is typically like, you know, ridiculously kind to everyone and, you know, a very just generally nice guy. So there, he was like obviously annoyed with him, and you know, Kiefer Sutherland would ask him about the blue rose. Then at the end, like he introduces himself to him, like at the very end of the scene, they shake hands. So that I found interesting. I also didn't realize that was his apartment. I thought it was just some sort of government building, but that makes him even quirkier of a character.
Yeah, he's doing all of these experiments out of his own like bachelor pad in whatever city. Yeah. Good old Sam Stanley is in. The line I always think of is when they're in Hap's Diner and Irene says, "Who's the towhead?" And now whenever Sam Stanley comes on screen, I'm just like, hey, there's the towhead.
That's what I always think whenever I see Cable. I think,
towhead.
Yeah.
One thing that I really like about this scene and about another deleted scene is, you know, when Chet Desmond is first introduced by Gordon Cole at the beginning of Fire Walk With Me, Cole makes sure to tell Sam Stanley he's got his own MO, modus operandi. And throughout several of these deleted scenes, they make reference to that. And Sam Stanley just, in some context or another, goes, well, you know, Chet Desmond, he's got his own MO. And I love the presence of that running joke.
Me too. Throughout I like this that. Year.
Yeah. So the next one is a pretty big one. This is probably the one that I was well, maybe most excited to talk about, or second most excited to talk about, but this is one that we both picked. Philip Jeffries. The scene is called Buenos Aires / Above the Convenience Store.
Yeah.
Essentially what this is we see Philip Jeffries in a hotel in Argentina, where we know that he was, but we didn't see this hotel in the movie. Then we see the convenience store sequence, but edited a little bit differently. And then we see him return to Argentina in a very funny way. But Matt, I know that you had some qualms with the way that this specific sequence was edited in Fire Walk With Me. And I'm wondering, does this kind of, you know, does this make things better for you? Do you like this, the way that this is edited more?
I did really like this. I would love to see just this one scene included in Fire Walk With Me, because you're right, I did feel like in the movie it was just very clearly over-edited and very clearly things were just completely cut out. And the jump from, you know, David Bowie being in the office for 5 seconds and then he just disappeared randomly just didn't quite work for me. So I was really excited for this. I was obviously expecting it because you had kind of teased it before. And, I mean, there's a lot more here. We get the convenience store stuff, which we had seen. But there's, like, characters in there that I don't think we saw before, because I remember we saw one lumberjack in Fire Walk With Me, but I know in this deleted scene there's another one. There's also... There's another character there. I forget who it is, but he says something, and it's just I didn't recognize him before. And Bob and the little man have a lot of more conversations. There's talk of, you know, along the lines of, like, with this ring, I thee wed, but just more of that. I did really, really enjoy that. And also the Miss Judy references. There's more of that, which wasn't really explained anymore, but still confused.
Yeah, so, like, what is Judy? Why is Jeffries looking for Judy in Argentina? The very opening of this, of this deleted scene, even before we get to the convenience store sequence, Jeffries, you know, walks up to the concierge desk and he asks if Judy was there, and he, like, receives a note. I don't think we ever figure out what was on that note. But yeah, and, you know, who is Judy? Why does a monkey whisper her name at the end of the movie?
Yes, that's right. There's a lot more slow zoom outs from people's mouths in this deleted scenes. A lot of that is really gross.
Yeah, one of the most interesting lines I picked up on this time, which I don't think is in the full movie, but it's said by the man from the other place, or the arm, whatever you want to call him. He says, "The chrome reflects our image." And I almost wonder if that's like a statement about television. You know, we look into the TV set and we see reflected from the chrome our, you know, what we see in ourselves. Maybe that's a reach, but, you know, could be.
I like that.
Lynch is meta sometimes. You might want to, you know, make a statement about this sort of thing. It feels like a lot more of the same from this convenience store sequence, so I can understand why they pared it down. But, like, also, it's so much fun to watch.
And there's a character, when they're doing another one of the close-ups on the mouth, someone says electricity.
Mm-hmm.
There's a shot of those wires at the Harry Dean Stanton trailer park. I don't know if they're emphasizing the number, you know, the plate that's on that light pole, but there's,
I think it's a number six. Again.
Yeah. And I don't, you know, I'm not really, because there was clearly kind of an emphasis on the wires and something happening with this and the electricity. And when they're in the convenience store, the lumberjack kind of reaches behind something and the lights start to, you know, go crazy. And then additionally in the police station, the lights start to go out. I mean, you know, maybe my understanding of that is maybe just, you know, that's kind of a representation, you know, with the wires all throughout town of, you know, some sort of evil force just kind of traveling, you know, just that sort of presence being there, but still interesting.
Yeah, well, we know that there's this evil presence in Twin Peaks, and it permeates all aspects of life. And if you think about what that sounds like to us in 2020, this thing that's just always around us, you know, it's always always affecting us. I mean, it's kind of like the internet, sort of social media, not to sound too, you know, curmudgeonly Instagram bad, but, like, it seems it's a very prescient vision, I think, from David Lynch, if this is the statement he's trying to make, that electricity is this thing that's gonna, you know, take over every aspect of our lives, and it's always just gonna sort of be there in the background. Yeah, it's interesting. I do like the emphasis on the wires. I like the emphasis on electricity, and I like the line that Bob says that's added in the deleted scene. He says, "I have the fury of my own momentum."
Mm.
I don't know what that means, but I like it. I also like that it really sounds like he says furry, because he's doing like the backward speaking thing, so it sounds like he's saying, "I have the fury of my own momentum." But you know, regardless, yeah. Very interesting line, very interesting scene.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly, but I feel like there was like some sort of tension between Bob and the man from another place there, just because he was giving him the ring, but then that line, "I have the fear of my own momentum," kind of sounds like, hey, I can do this on my own, like I'm going to use my own power for this. And there seems to, maybe be some sort of power struggle, some power hierarchy going on, at the end of Firewalk With Me, kind of making Bob release, the pain out of Leland. I always kind of sense there's something's there. And then a cool effect is, when Bob leaves from the convenience store, you kind of see in the little man's eyes a rush of fire. Kind of like what happens Wyndham Earl in the last episode of season 2.
Mm. Yeah, no, those are some great connections to make. But moving along in this scene, we see Jeffries come out of the elevator in a similar way to how he does in the movie. And he says he's not going to talk about Judy. He's been to a meeting. It's like the same stuff as before, but it's not intercut with his description and the convenience store sequence. It shows us one, and then it shows us the other. I know that you like this way better. I don't really have a preference. I like them both.
I love the ending here. We talked about this on the episode on Firewalk With Me, but when he says Mayday and then looks at the calendar, realizes, ostensibly that he's there too early. And that, he knows that Cooper's going to be in the room and he came too early. He has to come later on. And then he just disappears. I wish that was in the movie. That's a really cool inclusion.
Yeah, I mean, and it's great because he has the line where he says, "Who do you think that is there?" And he points at Cooper. From his perspective, if he, came from the future, he knows that Cooper, that's not Cooper, that's Cooper's doppelganger. And he doesn't realize that, no, this is the real Cooper still at this point. So, also, just like watching it as a prequel, but like it came out because prequels come out after the originals, so like we're sort of watching it from Jeffrey's perspective in a certain way.
Yeah, you're right. I didn't think about that.
So I love Jeffrey's disappearance. I don't think that we need in the movie to see where he goes. I think that sort of ruins the magic of it. See that he goes back to Argentina, but. Damn it if I don't love this guy, this poor concierge in Argentina saying, "The shit, it come out of my ass."
it's so weird.
It's ridiculous, but it's just perfect. Like, I'm so glad that this moment exists. And, like, this is the best thing that I can say about an inclusion to the missing pieces, that I don't think it fits in the movie at all. I don't think that this moment fits. But I'm so glad that it's in the missing pieces.
It's hilarious and comes out of nowhere. And, like, the lady's on the ground and trying to crawl away. Like, we don't know. She just fell over randomly, I guess. It's absurd. But I guess he goes back to the hotel, and maybe that's his little, time-traveling spot in Argentina.
Yeah, is the hotel in the future? Is the hotel in the past? I mean, is a question that the arm asks to Cooper, is it future or is it past? And we may never know. Our next one that we want to talk about is one that you selected. It's a dinner scene with the Palmers. I'll let you describe that one, since this is one of your selections.
Yeah, so this is one of the ones that they talk about in the interview that me and Logan were discussing. What's the name of the interview?
Between Two Worlds.
Between Two Worlds. It's with the Ray Wise, Grace Zabriskie, David Lynch, and Cheryl Lee. And it's funny because they were just talking about how absurd this scene was, and they were like, "I think we recorded that. Did that make it into the movie? I don't know. Like, where is that?" It's they're all sitting around the dinner table, and Leland walks in, but he doesn't walk in. He kind of stomps in, and he's got this big booming voice. and he's yelling, he's shouting, and it's like kind of amusing to them. They're laughing. But then before he sits down, he kind of turns around this wood panel that's, you know, against the china set, the china cabinet, and on it is an axe, which is kind of random. But it made me think of the lumberjacks, and it made me think of fell a victim.
Mm.
You know, this kind of like language, fell a victim, what you would use to, you know, describe felling a tree. So I thought that was interesting, you know, given that Leland is a vessel for Bob, and, you know, he is falling that victim. But the scene is just notable for its absurdity. He sits down, he tells them that the Norwegians are coming, and I want all of you to learn how to say these things in Norwegian. Introduce yourselves as the Palmers in Norwegian. And he has all of them recited, and eventually it kind of ends in all of them like screaming and standing and shouting. It's totally insane. I can only imagine what it was like, you know, actually filming that, and what directions David Lynch was giving off camera.
Yeah, I think this might have a place in the movie. I think that it captures the happiness of, you know, the family prior to a lot of things, and that there are genuinely happy moments in this family. You know, just goofy dad humor. He's stomping around the house. He was acting like a giant or like some kind of Paul Bunyan guy, and he's got this axe. And
now, did you think that was goofy dad humor or scary, like, manipulating Bob?
Well, it's a little bit of both, you know.
It did, and
Laura is scared at first. I think you can really tell when he comes in; she's scared. But yeah, you know, it just turns out to be kind of Leland goofing off, and then the whole family is goofing off.
Yeah, I like to think of it as like a sort of manipulation where he comes in and tries to, you know, if, you know, it's Bob walking in, is like, "Oh, I'm going to scare you, Laura," and then toying with her, and then kind of acting more like her dad, you know, kind of playing both sides.
Yeah. When I watch the Laura Palmer murder scene, I always imagine it as an axe that's being used to kill her.
I think it is, right?
It might be. I mean, I don't think that we ever really see the weapon, but based on the motion and based on the sounds, I think I've always just imagined it as an axe. So, yeah, I mean, seeing the axe here, and it would certainly make sense that if the lumberjack, or it's the grandson in that scene that says, "Fell a victim," right? He points at Bob, yeah, and says, "Fell a victim." If that is, you know, a command to Bob, then it would make sense that he's using an axe to kill Laura at the end. So yeah, maybe some more sinister hidden imagery of an axe there in that scene, rather than just, you know, just dad humor, as I was maybe saying. The next one that I think we have to talk about, that's on my list to talk about, is it's called Best Friends. Laura comes in. This is after Laura sees Leland coming out of the house, and that incredibly painful scene of great acting by Cheryl Lee. That's not included in the missing pieces, but this is the aftermath of that. She comes to Donna's door. She says, "Donna, are you my best friend?" They have a whole heartfelt conversation. And there's some interesting stuff that's added here. So Doc Hayward comes out, and he tries a magic trick, and it doesn't work. But what he said was, "I just tried it earlier at the corner of Sparkwood and 21, and the magic trick worked there." We know that now as the spot where Laura jumped off of James's bike and ran off into the woods to basically go get killed. And so I don't know, you know, do you think that there's something magic about that spot that allowed Doc Hayward to pull a rose out of a cloth? What do you make of that illusion?
Yeah, I kind of just viewed it as, you know, there's something special there, you know, some sort of force, some sort of pull. Yeah, this scene is weird. I thought specifically, you know, that line by Doc Hayward, which just sounded really forced and really like, "Oh, what? It worked there, but it didn't. Is it magic?" Like, it was just a little silly. Also, all the muffin references, all the muffin lines in this scene, out of this world.
Yeah, right, because in the pink room sequence, she says, "And I am the muffin." There, Jock is the great Went, and she is the muffin.
I didn't realize, like, the muffin was actually, like, a motif originally.
Yeah, I guess it was supposed to be. Now it's just kind of a weird thing.
Yeah, because at the end of this, she goes, "I am the muffin." And
yeah,
cries and walks away.
Yeah, but there's another little tidbit in this scene that Doc Hayward says, and it actually relates very heavily to Fire Walk With Me. There's a little piece of paper, and Hayward says that it's a secret message for Laura. I don't know why. I don't really know where they get this piece of paper or why Doc Hayward is the one who decodes it. We never see it. Is it written in some kind of cryptic, code? Is this a Zodiac situation where Bob is sending her, cryptic letters? I don't know. But what the message says is, "The angels will return, and when you see the one that's meant to help you, you will weep with joy." And I think that's a nice callback, or rather call forward, to the end of Fire Walk With Me, where, you know, Laura is seeing the angel that saved her, the angel that helped her, and she is weeping with joy. Very, very beautiful scene with beautiful music. And I like this allusion to that. I don't really know, you know, I don't know the details of where they get the paper or who sent this message or why Doc Hayward can read it. But, yeah, I basically like the inclusion of this line here, I think.
Yeah. I think that having the painting with the angel in it in Fire Walk With Me kind of satisfies that for me. But yeah, it is interesting that, like, where this note came from. It's very random.
Yeah, that definitely satisfies the need for that.
But this scene does kind of, like, strengthen the connection that Laura talked about in the diary between Doc Hayward and her,
mm-hmm.
Which we didn't really see before. You know, Laura smoking in there. He's like, "Why do I let you smoke when I'm a doctor and I don't let anyone else smoke in my house?" She's like, "Oh, because you love me." And he's like, yeah, I do.
Like Hayward delivered her, so they have a lot of, you know, history. And Hayward and Leland are good friends, so. Yeah, okay, the next scene that we have to talk about is Smash Up, and this is one of your selections. This has Ed and Norma, and I will let you take this one.
Yeah, you know, I love the scene because it's Ed and Norma, and this is a nice little peek into their lives pre-Twin Peaks. It's also interesting because neither of them are in Fire Walk With Me at all, I believe. And a lot of these deleted scenes...
We do see Norma for, like, a hot second when she's telling Shelley to do Meals on Wheels, but yeah, other than that, no.
A lot of these scenes feature these, like, canonical Twin Peaks cast members who you would think would appear in the movie, who David Lynch, you know, pretty much cut out. You know, Hawk, Truman, Handy, you know, the detectives, Lucy.
Even Pete and Josie are in
I guess that was...
Pete and Josie are in an unnecessary scene with Del Mibler.
Very unnecessary, very too long. I guess that was an attempt by Lynch to kind of distance the film from Twin Peaks, which I think is a wise decision. Definitely one that obviously... kind of divided audiences because it wasn't what they were expecting. Certainly wasn't what I was expecting. But I think it's a smart move. This scene, I think, actually could have been in the movie. I think it's so beautiful. It kind of reveals that, yes, they've been hooking up, you know, kind of even before we saw it happening in Twin Peaks. And it's this really, like, tender moment. They're alone in Ed's truck out in the woods. They joke around about how, like, they're both too drunk to drive. So I guess, you know, they'll just stay there for the whole night. And Norma is like, "All right, let me find something to play on the radio." She kind of fiddles around with the dial and eventually finds a station that's playing, like, you know, the score of the movie and Angelo Badalamenti song. And it's super beautiful. And they kind of just sit there. And as the title of the scene suggests, Norma has this line where she talks about how they imagine themselves as not necessarily unlucky or lucky, but just a great big smash-up, I think she says. Mm-hmm. And I just thought it was... They have a lot of these kind of, like, haunting scenes, and I thought this was another one of them.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I really enjoyed that scene. I love seeing the two of them together. It didn't really jump out at me. I think I would have liked to see it in the series rather than in the movie, since the movie was focusing more on Laura. But
I definitely
enjoyed its inclusion here. It's always a joy to see the two of them acting together. So, yeah, that's definitely a good one. The next one is a selection of mine that I don't think you picked, but it's called Baby Laxative. Bobby takes a bag of cocaine out of his trunk, and I forget if he tastes it or he smells it or something, and he realizes that it's baby laxative, and it's not cocaine at all. There are three things I really love about this scene. The first is that it's an awesome visual of Bobby throwing this bag around. It's like, it reminded me of the sugar storm from Gone Girl.
Also, oh my gosh.
Also
that's
an awesome visual.
That's a great scene.
But yeah, he's got like, he's tossing around this bag and he's got like these white clouds around him. And he's so frustrated and there's just this like powder all over him. The second thing I love about it is that it explains a brief plot beat in the series where Cooper goes to Dead Dog Farm, I think is the house.
Dead Dog Farm.
And he tastes some baby laxative in the sink or something like that, and he realizes it's not cocaine. You know, someone was tricking someone else. So, just a nice callback to that. But what I especially love about this, and it's mentioned in another scene, I think less effectively, but more directly, is that we get the realization with this deleted scene that Bobby killing Deputy Cliff from Deer Meadow is completely unnecessary. Bobby shot this guy over the cocaine, and he didn't even have a reason to. He shot him over a bag of baby laxative. And now, like, Bobby just has to live with that. Like, Bobby just kind of... Bobby killed a guy, but just for no reason, pretty much.
But we don't get any explanation, right, as to why it was Deputy Cliff.
No, we still don't.
Yeah.
I don't know if maybe... I mean, he's just kind of a shitty person, so I think maybe that's why he was involved in it.
Okay.
But yeah, there actually is a couple of deleted scenes later. We see Bobby and Laura in the basement, and there's like a line where Bobby says, like, I killed him over nothing. I killed him over baby laxative. That wasn't cocaine. And it's basically just like spelling out what we already were able to see in the baby laxative scene. So I don't like that scene as much. Nothing really happens in that one at all. But yeah, this was a really good one, and it was really memorable and showed me a lot about Bobby's character.
Yeah, the one line that I do remember from that scene is she walks in, she's like, oh, where's Bobby? And Major Briggs is like, oh, he's in the basement. And she goes, ah, where he belongs, right? So, damn, all right.
Wow.
Major jab.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah, I don't know. Anything about the baby laxative scene? I just, yeah.
It's a cool visual, especially with like the black leather jacket and the sort of baby laxative storm falling on his shoulders.
Yeah, it's a cool visual, very distinctive. Mm-hmm. Our next one, I believe that. Oh, okay, this is one that just you picked.
Yes.
Yeah, I go for it. Take it away, because I barely noticed that this one was even in here, but I'm excited to hear what you have to say about it.
Yeah, this is. By and large, my favorite deleted scene out of here. It's a simple one. It just shows something, you know, right before what we saw in Firewalk With Me. But it's Laura sneaking out of the house to go head out with James. But before that happens, what we didn't see in the movie was that she had to hide out in a bush because she sees her dad's car coming. This scene was really resonated with me for a couple of reasons. Just the horror of it. Specifically, I always find it terrifying in horror movies when things are happening at a distance. That's why It Follows was really scary for me, because it's just people following you from far away, which I hate. Like, just always scares the hell out of me for some reason. So that image of his car driving up and then just watching him kind of from the POV of Laura in the bush, seeing her dad walk up the stairs was really scary. But I just think it's such an effective moment where she's watching him. She's clearly terrified that she'll see him, that he will see her. And he stops in his tracks. He doesn't hear anything. He just stops. And he's looking straight ahead. But then slowly he just turns and looks right at the camera. And apparently he doesn't see Laura, but he's looking like right at you. And I just found it to be completely and utterly terrifying. Like one of the most terrifying moments in all of Twin Peaks. Ray Wise, always a brilliant actor, has this look of, like, you know, just this, the piercing gaze of an owl. The man looks like an owl, which is so fitting. And eventually he walks a little bit further, then he stops and looks again. And then eventually the moment's over and he just walks inside and Laura runs away. But I thought this was great because it makes, obviously, her death even scarier. It, you know, foreshadows that because that happens shortly after this. You know, gives more credence as to why she ran away so fast and just wanted to run away. And I think, you know, it makes the appearance when he shows up at the cabin at the end, you know, even more terrifying for her. I just thought it was an amazing bit of horror.
I I agree with some of what you said. I love Ray Wise's performance. I'm gonna have to disagree though overall in this scene. I don't think that this scene gives us that much like discomfort than what we can get in other scenes. So I don't know. I mean, that's just me. I didn't feel like there was that much in this that was new. You know, it's more of the same, and the same is good. But you know, by the same token, it didn't really stand out to me that much. I'm glad it did for you though. It just didn't really land for me in that way. It felt like I wasn't really sure why they stuck this in there. Maybe I have to go and rewatch it. But
it was particularly scary because up until this point, we've only ever seen, I think, Leland being creepy and very Bob-like within the confines of the home. And for me, this scene added like a whole other set of stakes. Where it's, you know, Leland's kind of limited, you know, what he can do to Laura within the own house. But, like, they were outside of the home, and it kind of felt like all rules were out the window. You know what I mean? And that, like, something seriously bad, and I kind of felt that danger from Laura, that something seriously bad could happen to her because, you know, no one's watching right now. That's why.
Yeah, that's fair. I think it also is a pretty cool lead-in to, like, when we do see Leland later at the cabin. Does he know that Laura is going out and he's going to try to come after her? You know, and I think that we know that some of these things that she does, hanging out with these like dangerous men or dangerous women when she's with, you know, Ronette and Teresa, a lot more Teresa Banks stuff in relation to Leland in these missing pieces, which we can talk about in a second. But like these things sort of make him angry, and so you know he comes to the cabin to see her, to see where she snuck off to, and yeah, that could be like sort of the inciting incident for killing her. But let's talk. None of the specific scenes that I you know wanted to talk about or that you wanted to talk about have to deal with the relationship between Leland and Teresa Banks, but there is still a good bit more exposition, I guess, about how their relationship started and how it ended in these missing pieces. I don't know. How did you feel about this stuff? There's like some phone calls between the two of them and some elaboration.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it kind of just fleshes out, I think, what we already knew. There was like a bit of ambiguity in Firework With Me, which I liked, where I kind of had to piece together, okay, you know, Ronette or Teresa figured out the relationship between Laura and Leland, and that's why then he found out and he killed her. So I kind of liked how they left a little bit, you know, for you to decipher in the movie. You know, there's scenes here, I think she's like calling Renault at the bar. I felt a little bit just unnecessary for me. But she's a great actress. I thought she was good in all her scenes.
Yeah, it was good to see. I actually don't know that that actress's name, but yeah, she was really good. Yeah, I agree. It's kind of fun to see, but feels a little explaining at times. There are three scenes left. I think we can just hit them all. The first one is Distant Screams. It's basically not even a scene. It's kind of just a shot. It's the log lady sitting in a chair in her cabin with her log, and she is just looking out the window, and she's hearing Laura's and presumably Ronette's screams. And yeah, I think this scene is really short, but I think it does a lot. It's really sad to see the log lady, who pretty much knew what was going to happen to Laura. See, to see her hearing it happening is pretty heartbreaking, I think.
It's so sad, and it mirrors what happens in Twin Peaks with Madeline's death, when everyone sits around in the roadhouse and, you know, cries and realizes something is happening, specifically Donna. Yeah, this was so sad, and she kind of looks out, and you see the moon, you see the night, and you can just hear the screams. Oh, terrifying, yeah.
Yeah, a similar sense of this, like, hive mind that, like, they know that sort of something bad is happening to one of them, but they're not really sure what.
Yeah. I think they totally could have put this shot in the movie, and it would have been, you know, definitely added for the impact.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, see, I think that part of maybe the difficulty of including some of these things in the movie is that maybe there are people watching the movie who haven't seen all two seasons. I don't know why there would be, but, you know, I'm sure there are. There are people who watch every you know, for every installment of a series, there are going to be people who watch it who, you know, haven't seen the rest of it. And so I think the issue with including, like, Ed and Norma and the Log Lady is that for, you know, for Twin Peaks viewers, this is, you know, it's a breath of fresh air. We love seeing Ed and Norma. And the Log Lady's appearance gives a lot of added emotional impact. But for general audiences just watching this in theaters, it's like, why are we seeing this old lady? Yes, general audiences. Why are we seeing this old lady listen to some screams? And is she, what is that she's holding? Is she holding a log? Why is she...
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I wish and they I would imagine... have been able to include it, but if they couldn't, I feel like it's fine.
And I can imagine that the studio executives that Lynch was working with would try to, you know, working with an already really weird and, like, divisive subject, you know, subject material, try to make it as appealing to a wide audience as they could.
Yeah.
As much as you can with Twin Peaks.
Yes, right. You have to make it somewhat palatable if you're going to have a wide release in theaters. And I think, I don't know, I mean, I think there's a chance that if Lynch had the opportunity, he would have just made this, like, a 4.5 hour movie and included all of the, probably closer to 3.5, 3:45 maybe. And he might have included all of these missing pieces. I don't know. Some of these, I think you can tell he wanted to have them in. Some of them you can definitely tell this was cut for a reason. But
yeah, I definitely some checks and balances in place for Lynch is sometimes a good thing, you know. Yeah. I think for any director, probably.
Yeah, I agree. It's sometimes a good thing, sometimes not. So yeah, all right. The second to last scene is called Lonesome Foghorn Blows. Also, not really a full scene. We kind of just see the body floating in the water, and we hear the Lonesome Foghorn. And I love this. This is one of Pete's first lines in the pilot. He's walking to go fishing, and he goes, "The lonesome foghorn blows." And, you know, here we actually get to hear it. Yeah, I don't know if you have any more details to add to that. Nothing really happened.
Not quite.
Okay. So, yes, the last scene that it feels like several different scenes, but it's listed as one. It's just called Epilogue. And a lot happens here, and I love most of what happens. The first thing we can talk about, we see Annie in the hospital.
Yeah,
and she's being rolled through the hallway. Yeah, surprising to see her, right?
I was so surprised, and just like the violence of the shot, there's blood everywhere. I mean, as soon as it came on, I was like, oh, okay, this is the reason people always talk about missing pieces, because I mean, this is big, this is new.
Yeah, this is definitely the reason. And a little bit later, we're skipping over some stuff that we can come back to, but a little bit later, we see Annie in her hospital bed, and she's saying the same thing. You know, I've been with Cooper and Laura in the lodge. The good Cooper is stuck in the lodge, whatever. The same thing that she said to Laura when she appeared in Laura's bed, and now she's saying it from her own hospital bed. So I love this. I think it's absolutely awesome that we get to see this happen.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but this comes after, you know, the words like some months later, right?
Yeah.
Is this part of the some months later?
It is.
Time period?
And I don't know why. Because the last thing we see is, you know, immediately after. Oh, well, no, I'm sorry. This is actually... That is correct. It is some months
later. This is the end of season two.
Yeah, so yes. What this is saying is the epilogue happens after seasons one and two, whereas Laura's death happens beginning.
We're now in sequel territory.
Yes, we're now in sequel territory. Okay, I was thinking that didn't make sense, but it actually does. Thanks for pointing that out.
I was confused. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting, just these scenes as a whole, because this is Lynch giving the audience answers. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe not clear answers, but he's giving us more than he usually does. And I wonder, you know, if he didn't want to film this, was forced to film this, or just decided last minute to cut it. I like that it's not in the movie, because I like the movie's focus on Laura, and ending the movie on Laura is great. This would have felt weird and just kind of tamped on if they threw this at the end of the credits or something. But when, you know, I love that this is here, and this provides some interesting information with the ring, especially.
I don't know what the first movie was to do like a post-credits scene Marvel style, but this would have been entertaining to see afterward.
Yeah.
So the ring is an interesting thing to talk about. And I think we get some more, rules. To be completely honest, I don't know how much we talked about this in our episode from like last week or 2 weeks ago, again, because we recorded that like a couple months ago. How much we talked about the ring in those episodes, I'm not sure, but yeah. So Annie is wearing the ring, during all of this, which is strange because Laura is wearing the ring when she goes into the lodge. Annie comes out wearing it. And then this, like, random nurse just kind of steals it off her finger and puts it on.
Yeah, and there's, like, an ominous shot, like, suggesting that because she has the ring, she's gonna get possessed, get attacked. I don't know. I felt like this kind of, you know, because most of what we talked about in the Firewalk With Me podcast was us debating, is the ring a good thing? Because the one-armed man threw it to Laura. Did it save her? You know, did it grant her, like, salvation, immortality in the Red Room or something? But then here it has this very dark feeling to it. So I don't know.
Yeah. I think my theory stands. My theory, I don't know if I mentioned in the last one. I think my theory is that the ring doesn't, you know, kill you or save you or anything like that. I think it just marks you for judgment. So Laura puts it on before she dies, and she gets an angel in the Red Room because, you know, she is the ultimate, you know, she makes a huge sacrifice. She pays with her life to end the cycle of abuse. She's not going to let Bob possess her. She's not going to become the abuser. She's not going to embody the evil that men do. She is going to die, and she is going to... she's going to let that cycle of evil die with her. And so she's good. So that marks her for, it marks you for judgment, and then she gets an angel or something like that. I don't know. So maybe Cooper doesn't want her to get it because he doesn't think that she, you know, he doesn't know the whole story. He doesn't know that she'll be marked as someone who's good. I'm not sure. A lot of uncertainty here.
Yeah.
But yeah, then there's just kind of this weird thing with the nurse putting it on. So, I don't know.
Yeah. And we are left with the question of, does Annie survive?
How is Annie?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know whether she appears in the return or not, but, I mean, she's injured, clearly, but can talk, can speak, so I don't know.
She's not in perfect shape right now. Yeah. She's got some issues, but is she going to survive?
Don't know.
There's a, yeah, and this last tag here, I absolutely love this. The scene starts with the glass breaking, Cooper breaking his head against the mirror. And I think this is such an interesting thing to put in the missing pieces because, you know, for 25 years, people have wondered, like, what happened after that? What happened after Cooper got, or Cooper's doppelganger made it out and he smashed his head on the mirror and he saw Bob? You know, what happens next? And we only get to see, like, a minute or two of what actually does happen next, but I think it's awesome. I love the way that Kyle MacLachlan acts this. His acting completely changes as a doppelganger. It's like watching Christopher Reeve in that scene in Superman where he goes from Superman to Clark Kent, like, instantly. And it's this fantastic change of performance.
Yeah, or to pull a recent example, it's like watching John Malkovich played John Cusack.
Yes, exactly. Yep, John Malkovich. Go listen to our review of Being John Malkovich. Probably came out 1 or 2 weeks ago on CTP. But yeah, I think he changes his voice, he changes his posture. It's so well done. And I love just seeing this. You know, he still hasn't brushed his teeth.
Yeah, there's the emphasis on that.
And we
yeah.
and we end on that ominous note, which I talked about what I think the significance of that is. I think it's not just like a goofy thing that he wants to brush his teeth. I think, you know, Bob prides himself on a smile, and we hear this line from the one-armed man that he wears a smile, everybody run. So I think it's definitely possible that this is Bob. He's in his new vessel and he's priming the body to have a good smile that he can be proud of and show off, and so he needs to brush his teeth.
Yeah, the scene doesn't like necessarily provide us with more information other than like Cooper, you know, if people thought he died or something, like, no, Cooper's still fine. It's clear he's still going to be evil for a while. It's terrifying. I love specifically when he's talking to Harry and he's like, I fell against the glass. It struck me as funny. Yeah. And he's like, dude, it struck me as funny. What, I just like this great bit of wordplay going on. It's so terrifying.
Anyone who uses wordplay is evil, for sure.
Oh, wordplay.
An instant sign.
Instant sign.
But yeah, really, you're right. When we think about it, what does this scene really spell out for us? I mean, the logistics of Cooper lying down and then being helped up, you know, that's pretty much it. That's all the new information we get. But still, for some reason, it is so effective to me to come back to this moment. We just recreating this vibe, recreating this moment. Yeah, really well done. I loved seeing this. This is probably, I think this is my favorite moment in The Missing Pieces, for sure.
Yeah, and at least for me, it ended, the Missing Pieces ended on the credits rolling over top an image of creamed corn.
Yes, me too. Creamed corn with some electricity.
Yes, electricity. Very interesting.
So, you know,
just reminding us.
Creamed corn, Garmin Bosia, Pain and Sorrow. Maybe it's, you know, it's tied together with electricity, TV, the internet before the internet in 1992, you know, social media. So
lots of forces at play.
Yes, lots of forces at play. Yeah, so, okay, I'm actually having trouble forgetting what our next episode is. I'm sorry, before we get to that, let's just do, like, kind of a quick wrap-up. Final thoughts, not really any ratings. We always do final thoughts and ratings on CTP, if you haven't listened to that before.
Yeah.
But just sort of, yeah, I don't know, just final thoughts on The Missing Pieces.
I really enjoyed it. I think there's a lot of long scenes, a lot of very unnecessary ones that you do have to get through. You know, but the payoff is immense. Like we talked about, these last two scenes are, you know, absolutely the most rewarding out of all these. These provide you with the most, you know, substantial new information, new looks into, you know, literally a sequel to what we saw in season two. Just, you know what happens right after. Answering those questions, which I think is really interesting. I think, you know, it was interesting to watch, not only as a Twin Peaks fan, but, you know, just as someone, you know, who might be interested in the process of making a movie, because you can kind of see, okay, you know, what did David Lynch maybe go into the process thinking he wanted to be in the movie? What was his vision for the film originally? It seems like maybe it was a bit more wide open to include these classic Twin Peaks characters. But I like to think that, you know, somewhere along the way he decided, and maybe in realizing the power of Cheryl Lee's performance, that, you know, the movie has to be solely about her and just really narrow it down to that, which I think was a wise decision. Even if he made fans wait, you know, 25 years or whatever for this information, I like that he kept Fire Walk With Me very direct, very focused. I can only imagine, you know, what it was like in 2014 to hear news of this being released as a Twin Peaks fan. I'm sure that was, you know, massive. We have the privilege and the benefit of talking about this in 2020, so far removed from when everything was, you know, coming out. But overall, I thought this was really, really cool. Definitely something worth checking into if you're a Twin Peaks fan. Definitely go check this out.
Yeah, it's weird talking about deleted scenes because, you know, on the one hand, like, they were deleted for a reason. And I think with a lot of these, you can really tell, like, yeah, this adds nothing. You know, they're able to establish this in another scene with less dialogue or, you know, these things. I mean, a lot of these you watch it and you're like, okay, so that's why it was cut. Like, it's really obvious to see. But I think what's cool about it is not that all of these scenes are, you know, on par with the quality of the scenes that exist in Fire Walk With Me, but the fact that, like, Lynch wouldn't have shot them if they didn't, you know, quote-unquote happen canonically. And so I think that's what's interesting about it, watching it as a fan, is that it's sort of building the world, it's building the canon. And I think with a lot of these things, I'm totally fine with them not making it into the movie. A lot of the missing pieces, honestly, is just kind of wasted time. But, you know, it's fun to watch wasted time. And, yeah, it's an immense payoff at the end, these last few deleted scenes. So, yeah, overall, I really like the missing pieces. And as a unit and individually, I like most of them. But they're just, you know, again, you can see why they were deleted. They're deleted scenes for a reason, and they're not in the movie for a reason. So Matt, we are getting dangerously close to part one of The Return, but I believe we have two more episodes before that.
Yes, we do. The next one that we're going to be talking about, we're going to be revisiting the pilot. We're going to be going back to where it all started, talking about episode one. I know, at least for me, I have not watched the pilot. I think we did, since we did the podcast on it. So that's going to be really interesting. For that, I'm thinking that we're both going to go back and listen to our first Back in Style as well, to kind of chart along with the show where our show has grown. I'm sure it's going to be interesting, you know, to see how rudimentary it is, to see how rough the conversation is, because I think we have genuinely kind of slimmed it down and made it a lot more streamlined than what it used to be. So that's going to be interesting, you know, if you've been listening to the show for a while, that'll be cool. Or if you haven't, go back and listen to the first one in preparation. But then from there, we're going to be talking about Mulholland Drive and its connection to Twin Peaks, which is kind of... not super strong, but originally it was planned to, you know, be part of Audrey's character. Obviously went in a lot of different directions, but still it's going to be great to talk about a David Lynch movie, a David Lynch piece other than Twin Peaks on this podcast, because, spoiler alert, I love that movie to death. And yeah, like Logan said, from there we're tackling The Return.
And
super excited to do that. Can't wait.
And Mulholland Drive is also going to be a little bit of a revisiting. It was our, I want to say, fourth episode or sixth episode of I think it might have been our sixth episode of the Cinema Talk podcast. This was before Matt was on, is when it was just three hosts, and I haven't listened to that podcast in so long, and I'm so scared to I'm scared to hear, you know, what dumb observations we made about the masterpiece that is Mulholland Drive, and the probably too low rating that I gave it, because I was like coming off of my first watch and not really understanding it. I love Mulholland Drive, and I'm really excited to talk about it more in depth. And also, you know, since we have already discussed it, it's not just going to be like a basic, you know, figuring out of what happened. As I remember it, when we reviewed it on C2P, it was basically just like us trying to figure out what the plot was, which probably didn't make for a very interesting listen.
To be fair, that might be me on this episode, because I was not on that podcast.
Yeah, maybe.
And I'm still trying to work it out in my head myself.
Maybe. But, you know, regardless, we're going to have it. We're going to have the lens of Twin Peaks to look at Mulholland Drive through. So I'm really excited for that. Until that happens, though, you can check out a lot of other shows on the network. Matt, would you like to tell us about some of those?
Yep. So we have our main flagship show. That'd be CTP. We do long, in-depth, long-form discussions on movies. We just did one on Charlie. Actually, I don't know where we are at right now, but we're doing our Charlie Kaufman series, we'll say. In addition to that, we've got the CTP Movie Journal, which me and Floyd haven't done in a while. But the main thing there is our Best of the Decade podcast. We talked about our favorite movies from the decade. Kind of a big accomplishment, and we are very proud of that. Additionally, we have our comedy podcast. It'll be Stop, Wait, What? That's hosted by Brendan, who you can hear on CTP as well. That's a lot of fun. They take answers, questions from Yahoo Answers, and give comedic responses to them. We also have the what's the spooky one called?
It's been a while. Twisted Mug Mysteries. Your one-stop shop for everything spooky.
Your one-stop shop for everything spooky and occult. That's right. That's also hosted by Brendan. We also have Acto Island, which is our premier Star Wars podcast. Haven't done that in a while, but we're kind of going through Clone Wars right now.
Maybe doing some Mandalorian stuff soon. Maybe we've already started that. So go, I don't know, go see if that's on the feed.
Yeah, and obviously any Star Wars news that comes out, we'll discuss it there. We also have...
I would play that.
I Might Play That, which is our video game podcast, also hosted by Brendan. That's a lot of fun.
I think that's all of them.
I think that's just about everything. Sorry, there's a lot on this channel.
Yeah, and it's all on one feed, so you can find it all right here on wherever you're listening, Spotify, iTunes, or Podbean, which is our host site. So, yeah, you can find it. You can find everything here. Check out those other stuff. You can also find us on Instagram and Twitter at Twisted Mug Media. You could email us twistedmugmedia@gmail.com. We also have a relatively new YouTube channel that doesn't have that much on it, Twisted Mug Media Network, and we have a Cinema Talk Podcast Letterboxd account. If you go there, you'll see entries for all of the movies that we've reviewed on CTP. Just search search Cinema Talk Podcast, not Twisted Mug Media. Search Cinema Talk Podcast, and you'll find it there, and as well as the movies that we review there. In the bio of the CTP page, you will be able to find all of our individual accounts, so you can see what Matt and I are watching in our free time, as well as what Brendan and Ryan are watching. Is there anything else for us, Matt, today?
I think that's just about everything. As always, join us next week. Join us in 2 weeks whenever the next Back in Style comes out. But as always, there's a lot of stuff coming out on the channel. Thanks for listening, guys. It's a lot of fun. We are moving ever closer to the return. Very excited.
Yes, I'm really excited to get there. Hopefully Ryan can join us for as much of that as possible. And come back next time. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time.
See you.